and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week. Thanks for taking your time to be with us. Tonight I have with us Dr. Friedman Schaub. Dr. Schaub is a cardiologist, but he's writing about how to treat anxiety holistically from his perspective. So thank you, Dr. Schaub, for taking the time to be with us, and I'm sure that my listeners will really enjoy hearing what you have to say about anxiety. I know I will, because I suffer from that thing. So,
well, don't we all do in some level? This is certainly a very common issue in our society.
It really is. So before we get started, would you just take a few minutes and tell people where they can find you and your book and who you are and kind of how you came to do what you're doing?
All right. So basically, the book is called The Fear and Anxiety Solution. And if you are interested in finding out more about the work I'm doing and also the book, you can either go to the website thefearandanxietysolution.com in one word, or cellularwisdom.com, also in one word. I'm stationed in Seattle, but I'm working with clients all over the world via Skype or the phone on helping them break through fear and anxiety by accessing also their innate healing powers of the subconscious mind.
And, I didn't realize you were in Seattle.
Yeah.
I need to introduce you to that person I was telling you about. I'm sorry. Go ahead. It just caught me off a little bit.
Well, basically, I started out my career in cardiology and just found after some time that it wasn't really satisfying me to work in a huge cardiology department of a university hospital. And basically, you know, I have one patient after another come in, get a stent or get some kind of an intervention, get a little bag of medication, and off they go. And often they came back 6 months later with similar problems. And for me, it just felt like more that we are focusing on the symptom, that we are focusing on that part of the body versus seeing the person more holistically as a whole being. So I took some time out and went into research and focused on molecular biology. And what research really gave me is what medicine didn't give me, which is a trust and a belief in the healing capacity of each and every cell of our body. In medicine, we are focusing on the flaws and the weaknesses of the body and how to treat them and how take care of them. In research, we discover so much about the adaptability and the capabilities of each and every cell in our being. So it was certainly for me an eye-opener, and I focused for the next 7 years on specific research, which was called an apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. But after that time, I also realized that I want to go back in helping people to heal using now all this information I have gathered from these two different careers. And my question was, how can we now access this innate healing power? What's the key to that? And the key is the subconscious mind, because the subconscious mind is in charge of our emotions, our beliefs, and is also in charge of all those body functions that we are not consciously really regulating. And so I became more and more interested in that mind-body connection and how to work with that connection, and especially with the subconscious mind. And so I specialized in various mind-activating modalities such as NLP and timeline therapy and clinical hypnotherapy, and then became basically fascinated in helping people on that level. developed a program, a breakthrough program that helps people especially to address their deeper root causes of their emotional challenges, such as fear and anxiety. And now, another 12 years later, here we are.
So I've got a lot of questions for you, but before we move on, I was interested in one of your research citations of mediated activation of a specific program of inflammatory gene expression in vascular smooth muscle cells. What did you do there?
Well, basically, what I was researching or doing research on was about what happens when cells are dying in the arteries. And we know that arteriosclerosis, which is the narrowing of the arteries, is often preceded by cell death. And the question was, when cells are dying, what happens with the dead bodies? You know, do these cells basically dissolve? Do these cells taken away? What happens as a consequence of that? And why do these cells die in the first place? And what we found was that many of those cells in the walls die from this so-called apoptosis, which is a really fascinating subject. The programmed cell death. And programmed cell death means that there is no external influence on the cell. So there is no toxin, there is no bacteria or anything that is actually causing this cell death. This is something that more internally the cells, quote unquote, decide to undergo this death, why it's also called programmed suicide, cell suicide, for the greater good of the entire organism. We actually, all of us, have billions of cells dying every day with that apoptotic process. What wasn't really clear is what happens when these cells are dying. And I found in my research that the cells right before they are dying actually are signaling to those immune cells that they are required to come in and take those cells away from the site of their death and basically, remove them. It's almost like they are sending out invitations for the funeral right before they are actually committing suicide. And it's a very amazing and organized process, which once again was pointing out to me that there is an innate intelligence in every part of us that we just need to learn to work with, to trust, and also to really utilize in better ways than we have in the past.
That's very interesting. So when that happens, does the person always die, or does the person sometimes make it? Is it like an indication of the end of your time? Or do they?
No, not at all. I mean, you have probably today 20 billion cells that died this way. They need to die, the cells, because there's so much growth inside of us. There's a huge turnover, which is why, we don't really have the same body than we had, that we had 5 years ago. The cells have been, basically changing. Most cells have been dying and have been replaced by new cells to come in. And so it's just a constant growth process. There are only a few organs, like the brain and the heart, that don't undergo this process of renewal. And even there, these days, there are questions if they're not stem cells that actually can also renew the cells that we in the past thought, are basically those that are just one-time cells and they don't get replaced.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have one more question about another study you quoted, and then I'll move on into what you have to share, but I'd like to lead in with this thing. There's another study, anxiety characteristics independently and prospectively predict myocardial infarction in men. What kind of characteristics are there that predict this?
Well, basically, it's when people have been consistently struggling for a longer time with anxiety and as also a reaction to anxiety, with frustration and anger and that type A personality, that is certainly a factor that, which is interesting, while I was in cardiology, was completely poo-pooed, and in the meantime got more and more attention as certainly a very important factor to consider when it comes to heart disease. This is also true. There was a study recently in women that showed that there was a correlation between marital problems and heart disease in women and women pre-menopause. You know, there is certainly a certain protective mechanism that estrogen levels can, especially with the heart, provide women. This is why women in general are not so prone to myocardial infarctions when they are younger as men. But there is again the stress factor that showed that when, you know, over years there's a greater anxiety or fear or lots of problems in the marriage accumulating, that also correlates with a greater risk for heart disease.
Okay. So earlier in your conversation, you talked about conscious mind. Do you ever use the phrase consciousness?
Well, I love the word consciousness, but I'm not sure if when we talk about the conscious mind, if that would be the only way I would use consciousness. I think consciousness probably includes all of those three mind aspects or consciousness aspects, and maybe even more, that I describe in the book. So there is the conscious mind, the rational mind that, you know, we definitely are operating with for most of the day. Then there is a subconscious mind, which we don't really pay so much attention to. But then on the other hand, it really shows that about 75 to 80% of our daily activities are actually run by the subconscious mind. And then there is the higher consciousness, which really I don't necessarily know how to describe, other than that it goes beyond the subconscious and the conscious mind. But it's certainly when you are stepping into this place of the higher consciousness, you have a sense of being beyond that that realm of the other two minds.
That's exactly what I was looking for, because I found that is a huge dilemma in the world today, because people, particularly researchers in quantum mechanics and medicine, are using that word, but they all have a different meaning, so nobody has a meeting of the minds and they don't know it. So I wanted to see what, you know, where you are, which leads me to this question. And you don't have to answer this question if you don't want to. It's just what's something that I have learned to ask since I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people like yourself over the years. Most people who have come to an understanding like you've come to understand that mind-body is more powerful than a prescription pad have had an experience of a dark night of the soul to wake them up to this thing. And people love to hear those humanistic stories because it lets them know that there's hope and that they're not the only ones, and not only are they not the only ones, but that the doctors who treat them are actually human beings and have them too. Did you have that?
Well, you know, I certainly didn't have, near-death experience people describe, or the years and years of stumbling in the darkness. I think my whole life was more like a quest. And I think I started out in this life as a very carefree, happy-go-lucky child until I went to high school, and high school is certainly, you know, earlier in Germany where I grew up than in the U.S. And so you're still a child basically when you enter there. And I was, with my happy-go-lucky nature, certainly not the most ambitious student, which to the horror of my parents resulted also in not so good grades. And I God very quickly made very clear that this is absolutely not acceptable, which for this young mind of mine was a deep shock, because until that point, I really had more a feeling of, well, the way I am is perfectly fine. And from that time on, I was certainly going through certain, you know, events where it got reinforced, like the teachers believing that I'm not really that smart. And, you know, at that time, thank God, we didn't have any kind of diagnosing going on with kids. But if so, there would have been certainly some diagnosis made. And so there was a belief inside of me that I was never really good enough. That really came then at that time. And, you know, obviously I had to prove myself over and over with lots of stress and lots of effort that I need to be the best and that I need to be on the top of the class and that I need to be in the most prestigious cardiology clinic and that I need to publish in the most prestigious medical journals and all of those kind of things. And what I noticed is just that whenever I reached one of those highlights, it gave me about 5 minutes satisfaction and a 5 minute relief, only to drop back into the, okay, what's the next goal? What are they going to do next? What's the next expectation? And I think a lot of people can relate to that. It's just this outrunning of your limiting beliefs and the outrunning of the anxiety that basically keeps those beliefs awake and alive. And I think that's part of the reason why I got so interested in anxiety, because I realized what a slave driver it can be and what a detrimental factor it can have in our ability to enjoy life and to really have a fulfilling life. And it's certainly something that when I understood more about what anxiety actually is about and where it comes from, was also a really huge healing and, for lack of a better word, relief for myself.
So stepping aside from your personal body, your personal experiences, and stepping back into the body of a physician, do you think that, I understand that mind controls everything. I mean, I understand Bruce Lipton's work about epigenetics, and I understand the power of thought and intention. But do you think that nutrition plays a role, or can people overcome it with only mind, at least to start out with, or do they have to pay attention to what they put in their mouth as well?
Well, I think we are a holistic system, and what we put into our body is probably as important as what we put into our minds. But I think the challenge often is that, you know, we don't do either. And if people are, for example, saying, well, you know, now I'm going to eat really healthy and well, it doesn't necessarily prevent them from having the most critical and judgmental thoughts about themselves. And, you know, I think that's where, in our society at least, I believe there needs to be more work done, simply because there is not a lot of awareness around how we actually mentally and emotionally feeding ourselves junk food. You know, whether it's what we are watching in TV, what we are choosing to pick as entertainment, or what we are thinking we need to say to ourselves to get motivated and to basically be in that competitive race of life at the top, I think that's where there is less education out there than when it's about healthy nutrition and, you know, and what to eat and what to do for yourself in that regard. I am a firm believer that a balanced nutrition is important also for a balanced mind. And, you know, when we just think about how you know, there is really almost an addiction to caffeine and energy drinks in our society, that's obviously not good for the mind, because it just pushes our adrenals and it pushes, you know, our nervous system to the brink and makes us much more susceptible to all these kind of emotional you know, challenges that we anyhow are dealing with on a daily basis.
Okay, that's a great response. So let's get back to your book. What is anxiety? What symptoms? What does someone feel if they have it? And are there gradients of that thing? Do some people feel different things, or is it always the same?
No, I think there's definitely a progression when it comes to anxiety, and that's actually a really good question, because I think it's important for people to realize that they actually may be suffering from anxiety, although they don't really notice it. And what I find is that often people start with anxious thoughts that just can be random, doubting, worrying, insecure thoughts in their head that they don't really even feel a strong emotion with it, but it's certainly like this little nagging worrier or inner critic that just keeps on spouting these kind of thoughts. Then often it goes into more this feeling of anxiety, whether it's this undercurrent or these spikes of panic attacks. That's often the time when people say, okay, now I need to have some help because I'm feeling like, you know, there is some shortness of breath more often, or I'm feeling that my body is tensing up, or I'm feeling that I'm sweating more, I'm feeling that my mind gets more foggy. But most people don't really yet look for help at that point. It really goes to the often next level, which is when really the physical body is involved, whether it's, you know, insomnia, you have a lack of energy, or then chronic pains, autoimmune diseases, arthritis, you name it. Anxiety certainly can cause a lot of those physical problems. And I don't believe it's just the wear and tear of the body, because we have been plugged into, you know, like 10,000 volts, you know, 24/7 for years. I believe it's more like the next level of knocking at our door of awareness and saying, well, okay, now are you now paying attention? Are you now looking at what's really going on for you to make a change and to go back into a more balanced way of living and approaching life?
So is anxiety in any way connected with the autonomic nervous system?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, this is basically the autonomic nervous system is the part where, you know, it's almost like a flip or a switch that can flip from anxiety with the sympathetic nervous system being then activated. That's the nervous system that gets basically the adrenaline and cortisol and noradrenaline release. And the other side is the parasympathetic nervous system, which is basically that part that allows us to relax, to heal, to sleep, to digest. And naturally, we go back and forth. It's very normal for us to have at different times of the day different parts of our autonomic nervous system activated. So the problem is just when we are not ever getting into the parasympathetic nervous system place, and even while we are sleeping. And people that have been dealing with anxiety know that they feel after a night's sleep still not rested. They feel exhausted because somehow inside of them it was working. The mind was still somehow processing and racing. And so they never really have the feeling of this parasympathetic nervous system part. And, you know, learning to be more on that side of the equation is certainly a very important part of the healing process.
Thank you. I'm asking you these kind of off the wall questions because I want my listeners to have to get an idea that there is language for the feelings that they feel. You know, that there are body things underneath it, so they can go to their doctor and say, "Hey, I heard this person talking about blah blah blah, and I think maybe I might have that. You know, could you help me?" So, once you identify that you have this anxiety, what's happening in your body when you have it? What's happening in the brain?
Well, you know, what happens in the brain is that you have these, we talk about the anxiety switch, you know, this is they're called the amygdala, which are little tiny clusters of cells in the midbrain that are largely responsible for their anxiety response. And so let's say you, for example, as I described in the book, you're going out into the world. Maybe you take a stroll through the park, and then something catches your eyes that's hanging from a tree, from a branch. It's something that you don't really identify right away. That moment where you see that, your brain is taking that information and is putting it first through the midbrain and then also the cortex, which is basically where, you know, the thinking happens. And it is looking for information that could tell you what this potentially could be. You know, is this a snake? Is this a branch? Is this a rope? What is that? And if you have been now for, gathering information that scared you for a long time, or if your anxiety switch, these amygdala, are very sensitive and you're jumping at the drop of a needle, your brain in that moment will more likely say, oh God, this is something dangerous. It probably is a snake, and will kick in the stress response. Then if you have been relaxed and just not expecting anything bad to happen because your demeanor in general is more calm. Now, what's the interesting thing is when it comes to the brain, the verification of actually is hanging there happens in the backside, the occipital part of the brain, which basically is the last place that information is ending up to. So then, you know, finally that part of the brain says, hey, you know, no worries, it's just a rope, everybody can relax. So in other words, we are more first directed to look for danger naturally before we look for reality. That's just how we have been evolving for a long time. And that made sense when we were still living in caves and had to fight with all these elements and, you know, dangerous animals. But nowadays, you know, we have this amygdala, this anxiety switch, so sensitized that we are often over-interpreting certain things before we are really looking at what's really going on, what is really reality. And so that's where a lot of also medicine and medical research is focusing on: how can we turn the switch down? How can we make the amygdala less sensitive? And, you know, that's certainly one approach. It's just a little bit hard for us, you know, as people that want to actually deal with anxiety, to imagine how do we get to this amygdala. I kind of open up my brain and, you know, turn a switch down. So what can I do? And this is why I like to look at anxiety more from the consciousness and subconscious place, because it's more accessible than when we are looking at it from the neurophysiological place, which is a little bit sterile and inaccessible to us, you know, just from the understanding of what's really going on.
So is this thing that's going on involving the amygdala, is it a signaling thing, a biochemical thing? What is it?
Well, basically, it's a hypersensitivity of those cells. And what that means is that, you know, it's almost like an alarm system. When, you know, let's say, for example, you have, you know, a sore spot on your skin. And normally, you know, this part of your skin could be touched and you wouldn't feel anything. But when it's sore, you know, just the slightest touch makes you, like, say, ouch, this is uncomfortable. That's in some ways what happens with the amygdala. They are so sensitized and they're constantly basically on a we gonna charge and basically release the anxiety signal, which is both electric and also with neuroendocrine, that the smallest stimulation that comes from the periphery will then cause this cascading effect of the stress response.
Okay. I had to take a second and digest it. I'm sorry. So, where is the off button?
Well, you know, I feel the off button is in our hands, and it's our responsibility to actually not turn it off. You know, I think it's more like a dimmer switch, because let's face it, if you would turn off your ability to feel pain, chances are that, you know, you're slamming the door shut and maybe your finger is stuck, but because you don't feel anything, you wouldn't know that you have injured yourself. So we need a certain level of awareness to pain to be, you know, safe and then move through life in a whole and healthy way. And that's the same thing with anxiety. We need to have the ability to have anxiety, to also maneuver through life in ways that make us more safe. But we can turn down the anxiety to a level that we are reacting to internal or external information appropriately, and not reacting to it, you know, like people that have been dealing with chronic anxiety in ways that are actually self-destructing and often, unfortunately, also keeping us stuck, you know, stuck in a place that's called comfort zone, but it becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. And many people I'm working with reach out to help when basically their life has been shrinking down to the size of their apartment. Not necessarily only because they have phobia of leaving the house, but they just feel in general not really safe. So they have a very small life, and they go to work, have a very limited social interaction, and otherwise somehow just huddle down in their home and feel that this is all that life can offer them. So we need to really see anxiety as something that we can turn down and make it for us more a helper, important information that can actually be useful rather than the prison guard that keeps us trapped.
So do you practice a specific technique that you use with your patients, or do you use this at work?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is definitely what, you know, the book basically is about. It's my intention for this book was to share all the information that I have gathered in the last 12 plus years with my patients on fear and anxiety, and not just have a book that brings awareness on fear and anxiety, but really brings solutions. Because I think it's important for us to know that we can understand ourselves better, and we can find that way, that dimmer switch, to turn down the anxiety and ultimately befriend ourselves with the anxiety. So in the book, there are processes, step-by-step programs that lead from the beginning, which is demystifying anxiety, to really identifying the three major subconscious root causes of anxiety, resolving those root causes, and then building at the end of this book an understanding and so-called inner identity of yourself that allows you to really have a different frame to grow into. See, part of the problem with anxiety is that all people want to do is to get rid of it. But our mind doesn't work this way. When we want to get rid of something, somehow our mind just keeps on focusing on this even more. So just like as I would say, you know, don't think about a green mouse. All you would think about is the green mouse, because I told you green mouse. And if you say, I don't want to have anxiety, people think still about anxiety. And so if we get rid of the anxiety and not replace it with something, another way of looking at yourself or the world, there is a void that the mind will automatically fill with something, and usually it fills it with that what we are the most familiar with, which is, again, old ways of thinking about anxiety or thinking in limiting ways of yourself. So it's really dismantling of the roots of anxiety, the rebuilding of the understanding of self, that brings then, you know, the fear and anxiety solution to a person.
So for a physician who wanted to bring this into his practice, how do you do it? Because you obviously can't send a bill to an insurance company. How do you implement this to your patients?
Well, I work with patients one-on-one. You know, the sessions are usually between an hour and a half and 2 hours long, and we go through those processes that entail processes I have developed and processes that also come from neurolinguistic or other techniques that work with the subconscious mind. And it's remarkable how people are able to change in a fairly short amount of time. So when people do work on these processes and also commit to working on themselves in between the sessions, most people are able to overcome their anxiety between 6 and 8 sessions. And
between what?
These results are
between 6 and 8
six
what?
And 8 sessions.
Oh, sessions. I thought you said second. I was like, whoa, that really works well.
Yeah, I'm working on that yet. I haven't reached that. No, it's 6 to 8 sessions. So it's a, you know, it's an accelerated process. I don't believe that we can, with the mind, you know, create any shortcuts. I think the mind and also the brain plasticity needs to have time and space to develop and to, you know, solidify. So I think it's more important for us to, like, you know, Jung said, to outgrow the problem than trying to fix it. But we are definitely designed and we have evolved to be amazing in regards to growing and evolving. I mean, you know, when we think about how technology has evolved and how we have evolved with technology, I mean, our adaptability is unbelievable. What we just haven't paid attention to is how can we let our mind and especially our emotions catch up with all of that, what has been happening around us.
And your answer is to that question?
Well, the answer is basically that we are having to find, you know, where we still are stuck in the confusions of the past. You know, let me give you an example. So, you know, people, a woman came to me, you know, a few months ago, and she was dealing with a lot of anxiety that pretty much was like the red thread to her life. And she was highly accomplished, very successful, had pretty much reached any and every goal she ever had. But somehow she was still anxious, and somehow she always waited for that shoe to drop. And also, in her social life, she felt often just not adequate, compared herself, didn't really feel that she could measure up, and more or less isolated herself because of that. Now, all of this intellectually, when you look at her, when you look at her life, when you look at her circumstances, of course, doesn't make sense. And she tried to talk herself out of these irrational fears for a long time. But subconsciously, there is still something operating inside of her that just continued to drive those messages and to drive those patterns that had served her for a long, long time. And so when we went back into her history and really identified what are actually those root causes of her anxiety, well, one of the root causes was that when she was about 10 years old or 9 years old, basically after having heard many, many times from her father that she isn't good enough and that she isn't the boy which she was supposed to be and that because she's a girl, she's less than anyone else, she basically internalized it and she could remember while she was in a relaxed state. She didn't really remember it so much when she was, you know, thinking about it. It was more like when she tapped into the subconscious memory box that she actually had made that decision, that she is a bad and flawed person and that nobody's going to actually like her. that decision was deeply ingrained, kind of, you know, almost like a, you know, a personality, a belief that she was taking on. It's, this is where then the subconscious sets in and decides, okay, if this is how it, you know, how we are in the world, if this is who we are in the world, this is what we're going to do to maneuver through life safely. And basically that confusion and that limiting belief and all these emotions that are dragged to life since then are part of the root causes that need to be addressed at the source with the subconscious mind versus trying to basically either suppress them, ignore them, or talk yourself out of it. And this is where these technologies that allow you to consciously collaborate with the subconscious mind are so effective. Now, one of the root causes is what many people probably can relate to that are dealing with anxiety is the root cause of inner conflict. And what that means is that there is a part of us that still believes in the world not being safe or us not being good enough or that, you know, something will be taken away from us. That is like the inner protector. And that part of us is often holding us back. Many people say, well, you know, there is a part of me that sabotages me, that somehow always blocks me. And then there is the other side that, you know, is more positive and maybe more ambitious or motivated. So you want to take a step forward, and then something holds you back. Somehow there is an inner voice that says, you can't do this. Who do you think you are? It will not work out. That inner conflict is not something we are consciously making up. That operates on a deeper level. It creates a lot of friction internally. We are feeling like, you know, a car that tries to move, but somehow the brake is still pulled, and it certainly keeps the anxiety going. But the good news is you can resolve this inner conflict in a process that is also described in the book and find finally that there is a wholeness inside of you, this inner battle, this struggle, this tug of war with yourself can stop. And when that stops, you obviously also have a much greater sense of self and can more clearly see who you are and what you are about.
So I want to ask you, do you have a copy of your book? I don't know if you remember all these things. You have a fear and anxiety checklist. And
yes.
I think the things that you, it's on 231. I think the things that you've brought up in this checklist are very good tips for people to recognize when they're doing things to themselves to put them in that anxiety spot.
Yes.
Can you go
absolutely.
Over these things? And
well,
then,
so
let's see, we've got about, it's about 3:15, so we got about 15 minutes. So you can talk about that however long you want to, and then I'd like to give you time to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Cool. So basically the fear and anxiety checklist, I placed it at the end of the book because it also points out that even though you may have worked through all of this past fear and anxiety, you have identified the root causes and you have really gained also a new perspective, a new inner identity on yourself and on life, fear and anxiety still will at times come up for you, and there are reasons for that. And one of the major reasons is, and this is where the analogy of the pain works so well, that fear and anxiety is a signal. It is, for us, information that tells us, hey, you know, you have to pay attention. Most of the times, the fear and anxiety we are feeling now is not about external danger. It's not something where, you know, there is a tiger in front of your house or there is a burglar coming in. I mean, those things are the rare occasions. Most of the times, fear and anxiety actually tells us that there is something internally not working. It's something internally we have to pay attention to. But most people don't know that. Most people don't really realize that this is what the anxiety is really about. So we are checking more externally for whatever we can change or control or make sure it's okay, rather than actually looking internally and realizing that's actually what the fear and anxiety tries to tell us. And so the three categories of the messages of fear and anxiety are the questions that you can ask yourself. When you do feel fear and anxiety, you can ask yourself, is it because I gave my power away? And what that means is that maybe, you know, somebody like your boss came down the hallway, maybe this person didn't say hi, or they just, wrinkled their nose. And in that moment, you felt like, oh, my God, that means he or she is not satisfied, I get fired, whatever. Those things obviously make then that situation and that person more important than yourself, and you gave in that moment your power away. Or sometimes we have this feeling of having to please others and meet their expectations. Once again, the focus is on the external rather than actually saying, okay, did I overdo this? Did I make their needs more important than my own needs? Did I make their expectations more important than what I'm actually expecting for myself? And then there is the second category, which is, did I not take care of myself? Which, you know, comes back to the nutrition that you mentioned. Did I not eat well? So many people have a heightened anxiety because of low blood sugar. They haven't eaten all day. All they had in the morning was, you know, a cup of coffee, and then maybe they had some five-hour energy drink in the meantime. And, of course, that's not satisfying for our body, and our body kicks into fight-and-flight response because we need fuel to keep on going. And so that's the question to ask yourself. You know, did I not take care of myself when it comes to eating or sleeping enough or resting enough? Did I put too much on my shoulders, overwhelm myself? Or, you know, there's also the subject of personal boundaries. Did you not honor your boundaries and let people maybe get away with something or step on your toes, and you didn't say anything about that? And then the last category is the did I leave my center category, which basically means that we are often not really grounded within ourselves, but pulled away by outer circumstances, so where we are living in a what-if reality, where we go down this track of wondering what if, and really forgetting that in the what-is, everything actually is okay. Or we are, you know, doing things that although we know it's not right for us, we know that it doesn't feel good, we are still, you know, despite our better knowledge and values, do them. And I think people in their workplace are feeling at times forced to do this and leave their center this way. And then there is the very common factor of underappreciation, you know, where we are so demanding, we're so much forcing ourselves to be the best and giving it all, but we are not really appreciating ourselves for that. And we may hope to get that appreciation from others, but we don't really give it to ourselves, which leaves us, of course, more dependent on other people's opinion, which increases the likelihood to once again get anxious or at least disappointed if we don't get it. So these are, you know, maybe like 20 points that I'm listing there that really can help you as a little roadmap when you do feel fear and anxiety to go through this checklist and identify what does the anxiety actually tell me. And then you find in the book also ways to then respond adequately to this. And you will notice once you respond, it's almost like an inner compass. Once you found your center again, the anxiety will be gone as well.
That's a wonderful thing. It certainly is misery to be in that stuck place you were talking about. I can speak from experience.
It is.
So is there anything that you would like to talk about that we've not talked about, or even if we have in the last few minutes?
Well, I think what I would like to leave the listeners with is that there is not only hope for alleviating anxiety, but that anxiety actually is a catalyst for growth. You know, it is often said, and I have seen it many times, that the people really grow with their challenges, whether it's challenges of loss, but also, you know, going through an illness where they really feel like that made me appreciate myself more, realize what life is about more, and therefore grow into a better person. That is also true with anxiety. Fear and anxiety can really make you understand yourself more, heal the past more, create a clean slate with all those things that you have been maybe taking with you or piling up inside of you, and then learn to see more your potential. You know, if I could summarize what fear and anxiety means for me and what I believe fear and anxiety ultimately is about, it is that it tries to keep us on track to follow our truth and to live an authentic life. And when we are not living this authentic life, fear and anxiety just kicks in and tells us you're off track, you're not really where you're supposed to be. We just don't understand that message. So we have been demonizing that fear and anxiety is a disorder or a flaw or a weakness, and haven't really been understanding that this is a very, sacred and important messenger from the subconscious mind that only has our best in mind.
So we have about 6 minutes left. So do you well, I'll just say it this way. Personally, I don't believe that when you're trying to heal these kinds of things that you don't have to say that it was okay that it happened. Just to say that it happened, but that it's in the past. It's gone. It's done. And let it go. Do you believe that? Or do you say it can be
well, I don't think that this necessarily is enough, you know, because what often happens is that these events in the past create a sense of confusion. You know, I describe in the book a person who basically her mother had attempted suicide. She was, carted away to the hospital. The father was completely overwhelmed with two little girls that he didn't know what to do with them. So he just, without saying a word, went off to work. And the older one, my patient, was left with her little sister on her own. And so she basically took care of her little sister and then also took care of her father while the mother was in the hospital for a few weeks and didn't go to school without a word being said, basically took the responsibility of an adult being just barely a teenager. I think she was 12 years old or something like that. All that she remembered of that time was that she was anxious, that she was feeling completely insecure, that the world is not safe. That's what she remembered, and that's what was carrying through this, you know, life of hers until she was in her mid-50s. But when we went back and really saw this more from the perspective of this higher consciousness, where she could actually see it in a different light, she could actually see what an amazing person she was already at that time, how strong she was, how courageous she was, how she was without even thinking, stepping into what needs to be done, which gave her then a realization of she can 100% trust herself. She has inner resources that are helping her to overcome any adversities and deal with anything that life brings her. By having that realization, not intellectually, but really on a deep level, she could not only relieve that anxiety, but then also all the subsequent anxiety that fell into the same patterns, where she felt overwhelmed or not good enough or didn't trust herself. And in a matter of minutes, she had cleaned up from that pattern decades of anxiety and naturally felt like a huge weight had been lifted off her. And the beauty is when the subconscious has understood and made those changes, they actually are permanent. They don't go back. Once you get it, you get it. And that's really what is one of the the great advantages of the subconscious.
That's a beautiful way to put it. My language was not very good. I have many people say to me when I say, forgive someone for whatever it was that they did to you. It's not having to say that it's okay. It's just acknowledging that it happened. So I wasn't saying not to respect it. Please forgive me there if
right.
that's the way it sounded. That's a beautiful way to put it. It's a beautiful story. It really is. So can you tell us one more time where to find you and people can get your book?
Yeah, basically the best way is the fearandanxietysolution.com. That's one word, or cellularwisdom.com. If you're interested in the book, you can find it pretty much everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, in bookstores. You can order it as well through the website. Currently, I'm offering one-on-one sessions as well, so if you're interested in that, as I said, I'm working with clients all over the world, so this is something you don't have to live in Seattle to be able to do. If you're interested, send us an email, and we can give you more information, and then also if you want to set up a free phone consultation. And I will, in the fall, also start offering more webinars and classes on fear and anxiety, just to be able to reach an even bigger audience to make a difference in the world. Because once we overcome our anxiety and really tap into our potential, we can actually really live our purpose, that what we're here for, to what we actually all are supposed to do, I believe, to make this a better place for all of us.
Thank you so much, and I so admire you for following your path. I never got to ask you, you've got about 1 minute, what do your peers think about this idea, this protocol?
Well, I don't know what they really think. I think some probably shake their heads, and some are, you know, especially some of the colleagues in Germany who were, you know, with me on the same path and are now professors, you know, and head of hospitals. They may think that, well, classic me going to the U.S., you know, and doing something completely different. But I noticed, you know, over the last 10 years that more and more people in the medical field actually are open, and especially doctors that I collaborate with are open to the idea that going to medicine and approaching it with that approach, with the pharmaceutical approach, may not be the you know, best and most efficient approach for most people. And so I get a lot of referrals of doctors
Excellent.
That just don't have the time or the knowledge to really delve in deep and help people to overcome their debilitating anxiety.
I think it's wonderful, and I thank you. Thanks so much, and thanks for
thank
taking
you.
The time to come on. I really do appreciate it. Take care.
I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for your wonderful questions, and all the best to you.
Thank you. Have a good one. Good night.